Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Kiley.
I'm Judah Sanders.
And this is Engaging Culture, a podcast presented by Bridgeway Christian Church. We are all over the map today. We're going to talk about some new research that shows that a surprising number of self-proclaimed evangelicals deny the divinity of Jesus.
What?
And that folks of other faiths are identifying as evangelicals.
What?
We're going to discuss the fall of Bashar al-Assad and the implications of that and why we should care. And with the Eras Tour ending in Vancouver on Sunday, we'll talk a little bit about Taylor Swift,
shout
her cultural impact, and the impact of the Eras Tour. All of that and more on this episode of Engaging Culture. Well, hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Engaging Culture podcast. Brian Kiley here with Judah Ulysses Sanders,
yes,
the first.
Bartholomew.
That's not his real middle name. How we doing? We good?
Yeah, living the dream.
All
living
right.
The dream.
Best thing you saw this week.
Yeah, so I feel like I'm getting into this bad habit of like sneaking into, but I'm going to do it again. The first thing is I get to hang out with some students in Marin County for a program called SWAP, which stands for Student Wellness Ambassador Program, funded by the Marin County Office of Education, where we teach students how to advocate for themselves. I've been doing this for a while. Got about 100 students, and we get together every quarter for like an all-day conference where we just teach them a bunch of stuff. And we just finished for our third year. And those kids work so hard and are so incredible. And one of the highlight projects is that my eighth grade boys were not happy that in their bathrooms that there were not the dividers between the urinals. And so they advocated for themselves. They asked for funding for that to be fixed. It was denied. They staged a protest, a sit-in in the principal's office. And then they coordinated with the, like, what's the workshop class? Like, woodshop. And the woodshop students made them dividers. And the dividers, but here's what's funny. The woodshop students are mostly girls. And so the dividers are like covered in rhinestones and like
yeah,
glitter.
They are.
And they're like very, very pretty and like purplish and pink and gold.
Oh,
so it's like
gosh.
This boys' bathroom with this like very pretty set of dividers. So anyway, that was really, really cool. And just seeing those students really understand the importance of saying, hey, this is what I need is super dope. The second thing I'll say is I started reading a book called Half of the Sky. We're going on a mission trip to Thailand to rescue sex workers. And this book is by this woman who helps women all over the world come out of that and start businesses, etc. So it's this kind of anthology of all of these stories of women who have been through that. And it has really, we all know that sex trafficking is rampant and problematic, and we care about it a lot, particularly in this region. But I didn't realize how far spread it is. I read a statistic that said there are more people that are pulled into sex trafficking in a year, than the number of people who were brought in through the transatlantic slave trade.
Holy moly.
In a year. And it just was really opening my eyes to like how critical it is that we participate in ending issues that we care about. Like sometimes they sit on the back burner, but we got to step up and say, you know what? No. Let's bring this to the forefront. So
yeah,
that's a terrible thing, but one of the most impactful things that has happened to me this week.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. What about you?
As usual, yours is deep and profound and mine is very shallow. But this last Saturday night, 12 Bridges, which is, that's the community I live in. Mm. Our high school has only been around for a couple of years. I think it's their third year of varsity football.
Come on.
And they got to host the Northern California championship game for their division at 12 Bridges.
How
so
did they do?
So we went, my family and I. It was a wild game, back and forth. And the other team had the ball at the very end, was driving, and it just felt like they're going to get down there and they're going to score and we're going to lose and that's how it's going to go. And they ended up having to kick a field goal, which there's not a lot of field goal kicking in high school football, but their kid had made a 46-yard field goal earlier in the game, which is like very impressive for a high school student. He kicked another 46-yarder to win the game, which fell short, and 12 Bridges won. So pretty amazing. They are one of only, you think of how many high schools there are in the state of California, four.
right,
are undefeated. And 12 Bridges is one of them.
Come on, 12 Bridges.
Which is pretty incredible. So they get to play for the state championship this Saturday down in Southern California. And it was just an amazing moment. And it's been fun to see just the community is so excited about them, obviously.
No, that's dope.
And pretty pumped for the kids and all that they've been able to accomplish in a really short amount of time. So,
speaking of football, did you see that Michigan and Ohio foolishness? Oh.
There was a lot of foolishness. There was a lot of foolishness that weekend because there are two weekends in the college football season where like big rivalry games happen.
Yeah.
And Michigan Ohio State is one of the biggest
ones of them all. That's what I've been reading.
And I historically am a somewhat Michigan fan because my dad grew up in Michigan, but the coach they've had recently is named Jim Harbaugh, and he's just a weirdo. And it was
people are so upset with him right now.
Well, and it was very difficult to root for him. So I'm like, I don't know who to root for now. But now he's gone.
Yeah.
So I can go back to
when? As of when?
Well, he coaches in the NFL now. So I could go back to rooting for Michigan. And we were like putting together Christmas decorations like that Saturday morning, and we just kind of had the game on. And it was amazing to watch Michigan beat Ohio State. Ohio State was favored by 23.5
points.
Yeah,
that's why everybody's mad at this dude.
Yeah.
So wait. They're
mad at Ryan Day, Ohio State coach, because he can beat everyone else but not Michigan. And when you coach at Ohio State,
that's
all that matters is beating Michigan. So, yeah, it's, I don't know.
I may or may not have watched that little scuffle at the end maybe 15 times, taking notes in my investigation and watching it in slow motion to find out, like, what in the world
who did what
happened. It was really interesting. But one of the things that I read online was that it's very normal for them to plant their flag.
Yeah.
So I wasn't sure why it sparked, but anyway, it was really interesting.
Yeah, I don't know either. And just for context, and we'll move on, is that oftentimes if in a rivalry game, if one team is hosting the game and the other team wins, the other team will take their flag to the middle of the field and plant it in the middle of the field right on top of the other team's
logo.
They
said, not this time.
Which is a diss, like, for sure.
100%.
But, and, you know, I understand why you wouldn't want it done. But, yes, it created a big fight, especially at Michigan, Ohio State.
So, it was probably 100 people on the field.
Yeah, which is not great. So that was not the best thing I saw this week. No fighting took place. After the 12 Bridges game.
Amen.
12 Bridges game. So we're happy about that.
Amen.
A lot of cussing from somebody walking right next to us who was very mad at his team
losing.
Not at
the high school game.
Yes. But anyway, congrats to 12 Bridges and good luck on Saturday. We'll be right back.
So, Pastor Brian, recently we read an article about the phenomenon of non-Christian evangelicals. If you're like me, that probably sounds like an oxymoron. But this article talked about people who retain evangelical culture and identity without adhering to some of the core tenet Christian beliefs and practices. And so before we get into kind of some of the things we learned from the article, Pastor Brian, historically, what are kind of the core tenets, or how is evangelicalism defined? What does that mean?
So evangelicalism can be a little bit difficult to define for a few different reasons, kind of the foremost of which is there is no formal authority in evangelicalism. So what I mean by that is, say, in Roman Catholicism, you have the Pope. Within different denominations, you have levels of leadership where there, maybe not Pope-like authority, but where there is a level of authority to say, they are kind of setting what it means to be Presbyterian, Methodist, whatever. Evangelicalism is not a denomination. There is no formal authority structure. And that makes the definition of the word a little bit squishy. So I actually am less surprised that there are evangelicals who deny core tenets of Christian faith, and we'll get into that in a second. But historically, evangelicalism has been defined by four key traits, and these were first identified by a British historian by the name of David Bebbington, and they're known as the Bebbington Quadrilateral. So he says that the four points are biblicism, which is defined as a high regard for and focus on the authority of the Bible
Read your Bibles.
As the ultimate guide for faith and practice. Second is crucicentrism, which is an emphasis on the atoning work of Christ on the cross.
He died
as the central theme of the faith. So the idea that Jesus' death on the cross and resurrection is central to Christianity. Third is conversion, a belief in the need for individuals to be personally converted, or another term we might use is born again.
Yeah, getting saved.
The idea that we need to personally be saved. And then fourth is activism, and that is a commitment to actively live out our faith expressed through things like evangelism, efforts to transform society through mission work, social action.
That's the one we forget about, evangelicals.
We do. I mean, sort of. I hear what you're saying, but I think there are plenty of pockets of evangelicalism.
100%. We're one of them. And Bridgeway is one of them.
You know that, right? Yeah. So, first of all, Pastor Judah, those four, any issue with any of those? Like, those sound pretty good to me.
No, I mean, that's kind of how, you know, my faith is. It's so funny because I often think about myself as an evangelical. I think about myself as a charismatic. Mm-hmm. But those are kind of the core tenets kind of how I live. You know, I believe. There are some people who also add... who will say, instead of the activism piece, evangelism specifically, mm-hmm. right? The idea of, like, you got to go out and tell people, go out and bring people in. But no, I don't have any issues with those.
Yeah, like, those are all solid. And as somebody who has really struggled with evangelicalism, the term evangelical for the last 100%. Almost decade of my life, if you asked
really?
Me, Brian, are
that
you
long?
An evangelical? I would say no. Uh-huh. And even though I affirm all four elements of the Bebbington Quadrilateral, but my reason for that is that I don't know if you know this, Pastor Judah, but the definition of words can change over time.
Imagine that.
Right? The last line of the Flintstones theme song, by the way, didn't think I was going to go there, did you, is, we'll have a gay old time. And that is not talking about homosexual activity. Yeah. That is talking about fun. That we don't use the word gay to describe fun anymore, right? Now, that is a sort of, that is an extreme, exactly. It does not mean happy anymore. I'm blanking on the Christmas Carol that uses gay as happy also, but there is one. But I don't, yeah.
Yuletide gay, right? It doesn't matter.
I don't know, whatever. So my point, and that's kind of a silly example, but the meaning of words changes over time. Mm. And there is a lot of research to suggest that culturally, the term evangelical is more defined by a social movement than a core set of theology. In fact, this research that we read, which is pretty wild to me.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy.
And this is like high quality research, suggested that in 2022, almost 50%, 43% of those who self-identify as evangelicals affirmed the statement, Jesus was a great teacher, but he was not God.
Which is wild.
Like you might be a nice person. You might be morally upright. You might be any number of wonderful things. But if you say Jesus is not God, like, you are not a Christian.
100%.
Like, that is just
Actually often the language that our brothers and sisters who practice Islam use. Well, they will say, hey, we don't believe in Jesus, that Jesus was God. We just believe that he was a good moral teacher and a very smart person, right? A good prophet.
So what do you make of the fact that so many people would say, or at least answer on a survey, and this is pretty robust research. It wasn't just like a one-and-done kind of thing. That they would answer yes to being an evangelical on a survey, but they would say no to Jesus being God. What do you make of that?
I am so unclear about what to make of it because I don't know how you get there, right? In terms of, like, evangelicalism to me is so the church. It's so, like, fundamentally Christian. And so the idea that it can move from theological to purely social or purely cultural without even the idea of it being attached to God. Because I could believe that there are evangelicals who are more about the cultural elements of it or more about the political pieces of it, the kind of political ideology that's like currently kind of saturated the evangelical community. But I would, if you had asked me before I read this, I would have said, well, you know, they at least say they believe in Jesus, even if maybe their lives don't reflect that, etc. The fact that so many of them themselves know or will say, hey, we don't believe in Jesus as God, is wild, because to me that means that you must have thought about it, mm-hmm. that you have really processed this and made a decision to not believe in God. And what's even wilder, one of the things in the research was that this is persistent, particularly in young evangelicals or young people, you know, who will say that. And so I don't know. What do you, I mean, how did you feel reading that, and what do you think that's about?
It validated a lot of the concerns I've had about the direction evangelicalism has gone, and like why, even though I am very quote unquote evangelical in my theology, why I do not claim the label personally, because it has become, and I remember having conversations about this with people back in college. Like, I was in college, like I graduated in 2005, like this is a long time ago. And that there is a level of worldliness, and I use that as a very heavy term, and I don't use it casually. That there is a level of worldliness that has come to define evangelicalism, and by worldliness, what I mean is secular politics. That to say you are an evangelical says more about a secular political ideology than it does about anything overtly Christian. I mean, I remember even back when I was in college being really troubled by the fact that self-professed evangelicals were the most likely of virtually any social group that was surveyed to be okay with torture in the war on terror.
Yikes.
And I'm going like, that... Okay, say what you want about the quote-unquote political expediency of torture or the value of it in warfare. Like, for Christians to be okay with torture, like, that just doesn't work.
Yeah.
Like, that is so antithetical to what we believe. So to me, we'll link to this in the show notes. There was just a wild article written a while ago by a researcher named Ryan Burge called The Rise of the Non-Christian Evangelical. And it is pretty amazing. He's a data junkie, and he goes through and talks about how all the, like, multiple surveys, hundreds of thousands of people, there's pretty robust findings that folks of other faiths refer to themselves as evangelical. And it becomes more and more clear as you look at the data that it is more about secular politics than it is about any sort of like true faith commitment, which is a bit of an overstatement, but that's what the research suggests.
Well, and I think that's what's wild to me is that they know that they're saying themselves that it's not something that's ambiguous to a lot of these people. And so I'm wondering, Pastor Brian, what do you feel like are some of the cultural markers of evangelicalism now? Like, what are the kind of things, not the quadrilateral,
sure,
but just like today when you're looking at evangelicals, what are kind of some of the main markers culturally that you think people are holding on to? I know you talked about the politics. There's a political kind of ethic.
Yeah.
Are there other pieces that you're noticing?
Gosh, boy, that's a tough question. The political one is huge. And by the way, that is ultimately Ryan Burge's conclusion at the very end of his article. He says that the data is suggesting the word evangelical doesn't mean what it used to mean.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I'm having trouble coming up with words that are not like very obviously negative. And I want to be clear also that to say, like, I am deeply troubled by what evangelical has come to mean, but that does not mean that everybody who embraces the term has embraced
good.
All the negative sides. I mean, I think about the former president of my seminary, Mark Labberton, who was one of my professors in seminary. He's somebody, I don't know him personally anymore, but I deeply respect him and deeply respected him when I was his student, that he and a bunch of other, like, top flight Christian scholars got together and wrote a book. I'm blanking on the title at the moment, but basically, we're talking about why the term evangelical still matters and why they still call themselves evangelical despite kind of all the craziness. And I've seen other writing from people I respect to that effect. So there are a lot of like solid Christian folks who are like, no, the term evangelical really means a lot. And these are folks who haven't gotten swept up in the political stuff and haven't gotten swept up in all the kind of secular ideas. So I don't know. I'm gonna give you the politician's answer and just kind of punt on the question.
That's so funny.
I do think that there's a lot of good being done by folks who still claim the title. And even a lot of the work that like the National Association of Evangelicals does is solid and is not kind of been swept up in some of the more, I don't know, populist stuff surrounding the term. So don't know.
Yeah, I'm wondering if evangelicalism is really a cover, has become a cover name for something else, right? For a kind of homogenous community that wants to remain homogenous, right? That wants to say, hey, nobody else gets to come in here except for us. And I think it speaks to the danger of tribalism. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's what we're seeing really come out. How do you think that this reality, this phenomenon, is impacting the church as a whole and our witness?
It's hugely impacting because it is causing folks who don't fit in the secular political worldview that is highly influential in evangelicalism. And I keep using that word secular just because I want to make it clear, like, there is no such thing as a truly Christian right and Christian left. Like, right wing and left wing are secular
That's
ideologies
right. That's
that are like right. really like fundamentally incompatible with Christianity on a very basic level. So I want to make that clear that those who would be more inclined in their political thinking to go different directions assume that to be Christian means to embrace a certain secular political framework that they find troubling. Now, I would say to those folks that ultimately to embrace following Jesus will require you to lay down some of the secular political framework 100%. You hold.
Some of those, yep.
But it will not require you to pick up a different one. That Jesus ultimately calls us to a way of thinking about the world that transcends right, left, all of that. We talk about this on the podcast all the time. So, and I think also just something I'm constantly talking about with Christians, whether they claim the title evangelical or not, is just that issue of like, by our actions, by the things we say online, by the way that we act, like, what are we showing the world, whether it's our literal neighbors, whether it's people we run into in the community, whether it's people who interact with us online, what are we showing them about what it means to be a Christian?
Yeah.
Are we modeling a cruciform life? Are we showing that we are committed to the authority of Scripture, not just in quoting Bible verses or posting Bible memes, which is all well and good, but like truly being transformed and shaped by Scripture's values? Are we living a life of activism, not in kind of the negative connotations around that word, but in a way that shows we want to actually live out the values of our faith? And on and on I can go. So I think that the impact is significant when we live in such a way that folks are defining Christian as all of this kind of extra stuff and not, I mean, gosh, there are all sorts of surveys about, you know, people ask, what does it mean to be a Christian? And yeah. like, you know, Jesus doesn't show up in a lot of answers. So I think those are some of the impacts. How about you? What would you add to
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I'm concerned about a few things. One, I'm concerned because if you are not, to be a Christian, as you said, is to identify Jesus as Lord and Savior and say, I'm following him, right?
Yeah.
And if that is not what you believe, then I do not appreciate you using language that represents or makes people think that you represent me.
Yeah.
I'm like, can you find something else? And you know, what this really is about is cultural evangelicalism is really about the need to amass power, particularly for a conservative agenda.
Yeah.
And the challenge is that you don't need to use evangelicalism to do that. You could just say, I'm a Republican, and right. I would like to have these policy
yeah, sure.
agendas, which is a whole nother conversation, and that can be fine. I don't think that it has to be wrapped up in this kind of faux Christianity. And I just think that that's dangerous. I don't want that being what people who are not believers see and think represents me. It really blurs the lines, I think, between the church's theological priorities and a culture's, frankly, very worldly priorities, yeah. very, very, very fleshly and very human priorities. And not that those don't matter, right? Like, not that we can't have any conversation about what we value and want in terms of our politic.
Sure.
And I would challenge anybody who is in this camp who would say, oh, I'm an evangelical, but I'm not a Christian, or I don't follow Jesus, to not, because, one, it's not true.
Yeah.
Right? Even words actually do have meanings. And so what I'm concerned about is the potential that the evangelical is now a term that is becoming almost like a third party. Because with this phenomenon has come a tremendous amount of power that, and I'm doing air quotes in the studio, evangelicals have in terms of political influence. I'm really curious. I would love to like find somebody who identifies like this and listen to them and hear like how do you get there?
Yeah.
And why do you get there? Like, why is, hey, I'm just conservative, not enough, or I'm Republican, not enough, or I'm whatever, Libertarian, Green Party, whatever you are. Why is that not enough?
Why is the label appealing to you if you're not into Jesus?
Correct. Because I can understand if you're like, no, I do go with Jesus. And maybe sometimes I know I'm guilty of this, sometimes will impose my political views onto scripture or onto Jesus, right? Like, so I have to really hold myself accountable to that.
Not do that.
Right? That's one thing. But if you were saying, no, I don't fool with Jesus at all. Mm-hmm. But you're saying you're an evangelical.
It's very weird.
I'm having a hard time.
I share that curiosity. So it's pretty interesting to look at look at the research and just see how widespread that is. But
what do you,
go ahead.
Well, I was just asking, what do you think that those of us who are Christians and even the folks that you talked about who would identify as evangelicals, who are like actually evangelical, who really do lean into those four
followers
tenets
of Jesus. Yeah.
Correct. What are things that you think we need to be doing in light of this problem?
I think we need to pay attention to what's forming us. Mm-hmm. That's always true. That if it is evangelicalism seeking to assert power over instead of power under, so that meaning, kind of this authoritarian streak or, hey, let's get power, let's win a culture war, like that is highly problematic, that rather power under, which is the way that Christian power is meant to be expressed, is more grassroots, it's more influential, it's the mustard seed, it's the, I want to try to spread good, not from a place of imposing it on others, but from a place of living as an example, that is something we need to recognize. And then I just think, man, we just need to be aware of the fact, and I don't want to fearmonger here, but like conflict sells, hot takes sell, anger and fear sells. We are going to be formed in those ways if we're not consciously choosing to avoid them. And we open up our phones and we've got people trying to attach Christianity to secular political agendas all the time.
Yeah.
And to be rooted in what does the Bible actually say?
Yeah.
To be rooted in Christian spaces where we're seeking to exercise calm wisdom instead of inflammatory. Like these are just simple practices that we need to, make sure we are embracing.
Yeah, I think that there's something here that speaks to an identity crisis that I think perhaps the church is walking through. Right? Mm. Who are you? What does it mean to be the church? And so I think that we have to be really intentional because as much as we are, for lack of a better term, talking trash, right? Yeah. We're being critical of this phenomenon. I think that it's probably something easy to lean into, right? I think it's probably very easy for our complex identities to shift from a very inherent theological identity, right? Which is what it should be. I'm made in the image of God first. That is my primary identity. Everything else is secondary. Everything else is details. My race, my political ideology, my gender, all of that is secondary.
Yeah.
I think that because we now know that this is something that's happening pretty widespread, that the rest of us need to be really intentional about saying, Lord, continue to speak into my identity.
Yeah.
And I think the folks who are most at risk are younger people, right, who are susceptible, who are malleable, whose minds are malleable. But I also think older folks who have been Christians a long time, because I think that those are the folks who maybe are the most tempted to not think and pray and process with Jesus their identities in an ongoing way, because you say, well, I've been walking with Jesus for 25 years. This is who I am. I know who I am, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that we need to always say, you know what? As much as when I hear and read this research, I say, that's not me. That could never be me. It actually could.
Absolutely.
And perhaps in a different sphere, a different set of cultural ideas could be the thing that I could fall into.
Even non-political ideas, like some other secular way of thinking.
Correct. So, the risk for me, I think, is the activism space.
Yeah.
Right?
No, absolutely.
And so I think that we need to be aware of the risk. You know, the Bible says that the devil walks around like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour.
Yeah.
And I'm devourable.
Yeah, sure.
So I think awareness is really important.
Yeah.
And then I think we need to just have a series of questions kind of in our pockets that we can ask, because we probably know these folks, right? Like, as much as it feels like, oh, them over there, they're very different from, you know, even the evangelicals that I know that you know, you talked about your teacher. We need to have a few questions to be able to say, hey, tell me about this. Because the solution here, I don't think, is simply criticism. We don't have a ton of time on this podcast, so that's predominantly what we're going to do. But I think, really, how do we call them out to call them in, to call them back and say, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Aside from your ideas and whether I agree with your political ideas or not, Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, you know? And you cannot get to the Father but through the Son.
Yeah.
The path is narrow.
Yeah.
And to bring people back to that and say, hey, come back to Jesus. And then what we may find is, if you're walking with Jesus, some of those political ideas that maybe aren't so unhealthy, some of that lust for power that isn't so healthy, maybe that can be transformed.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. That's very well said. We'll be right back.
On Sunday, there was a global shakeup in the world when President Bashar Assad, president of Syria, was removed from power. Rebels broke in and forced him out. And he is gone. That's a big deal, because since 2011, there has been a tremendous amount of conflict in that region. And this is a big deal to see a dictator fall from power, especially one as powerful as him. Pastor Brian, what do you think this means for the world?
The implications of this for the world are going to be significant, or potentially very far-reaching, and a lot is unknown at this point. But I want to start with the fact that Bashar al-Assad is no longer in power is a good thing. This man is one of the most, I was going to say evil, but I don't know that that's quite the right word. But in terms of damage that a leader has caused to his own people, there are many, unfortunately, many awful leaders who have done awful things, but Bashar al-Assad is very high on that list. He used chemical weapons against his own people back during the Obama administration. President Obama made that like a red line in Syria, that Assad cannot use chemical weapons on his own people. And then Obama failed to enforce that red line. And millions of refugees have fled all over the world from Syria. There's been civil war for 13 years. I remember years ago, back when the civil war was really cranking up and Syrians were fleeing all over the globe, it was controversial, even in the United States. Should we be accepting Syrian refugees? And I remember that being a significant point of debate, even within the church. And you just look at the misery that the people of Syria have had to endure, the hundreds of thousands of deaths at the hands of this murderous dictator. And to see that he is no longer in power is undoubtedly a good thing. Now, the question that many around the world are asking is, what happens next?
Yeah, that's right.
This is bad for Russia. It's bad for Iran.
Yeah.
And people are questioning, is Iran going to speed up the development of their nuclear weapon, to try to get a nuclear weapon to project their regime? Or could this be a sign that Iran's regime is in trouble and that a more pro-democratic government could take power there, which I find that very difficult to believe that would happen. But maybe Tehran is as exposed and vulnerable as they perhaps have ever been. But Pastor Judah, recent history in the Middle East shows that toppling a dictator, toppling a regime that is harming its own people, does not necessarily lead to peace and prosperity.
Yeah, that's right. I think, you know, there's this thing that we do when we're talking about kind of international geopolitical issues where there's a temptation to oversimplify, right? And none of these things are really simple. And I also am thinking about how it's a good thing that he is no longer in power. But you think about all of the people that have been affected and will still be impacted for the next however many years, however many decades, you know, that removing him doesn't immediately fix people's lives, which is like, remember, that should be the goal, right? Yeah. Like the only reason that we should be in war, the only reason that we should be in these kinds of conflicts is to help people. I think that we need to not just like throw up our fireworks and say, yay, the wicked king is gone.
Yeah.
But to also say, okay, like what's next? Especially because, you know, the U.S. has been a main player in this, according to some of the things that I'm reading and learning about this conflict.
Yeah. No, that's true. And what happens next is so critically important globally. I mean, there are those saying that the United States should not be involved, and that really is not an option. I mean, Syria is so important to the rest of the Middle East that the U.S. has to be involved on some level, and certainly what level is advisable is well beyond my pay grade or my ability to speak to intelligently. But to return to a point I made earlier, you think about the celebrations that took place in Afghanistan in 2001 when the Taliban was taken out of power. Think about the celebrations that took place in Iraq when Saddam Hussein's regime was toppled. I mean, I remember the statue of him being torn down and kind of paraded through the streets, and the joy that people had at seeing this murderous dictator taken down. And as I'm observing the celebration in Syria, I see very similar images, right? But at the same time, you alluded to this, there is a tremendous amount of grief mixed with the celebration that as jails are being opened and families are fleeing to jails in search of loved ones, it's a reminder that their loved ones, number one, may not even be alive. Number two, have been in these awful prisons for years and years. Mm-hmm. In some cases, I mean, they literally read an article, people walking through the streets, holding up their fingers to symbolize the number of years they've been held
that they will
in
not get back.
And then I'm kind of going a little all over the place here, but to go back to the Afghanistan and Iraq example, we know what happened there. Mm-hmm. Those places descended into chaos. Mm-hmm. And so much of what I am reading is expressing concern that could happen again. And that part of that is that we don't really know a lot about the militias that have played a key role in toppling Assad, and that even one of these militia groups has been labeled as a terrorist organization by the United States.
Uh-oh.
So there is a lot still to come in Syria. I think from a Christian angle, there's a large Christian population in Syria.
Yeah.
And the words that have been spoken by some of the key militia groups express a tolerance and a freedom for Christians to practice their faith and to worship, but they have a track record of not being as Christian friendly as we might want them to be. But I bring this up on the podcast just for us to say, number one, this is a really big deal.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying we all need to read 47 stories about it, but this is something worth knowing about.
Being aware of.
And then I think just as a matter of prayer, to keep the nation of Syria in prayer, that you think about, I mean, gosh, I'm reading stories about refugees coming back. You think about how much people wanted to be in their land. The regime's been down for a day and people are coming back, right?
Wow.
Like to get to their home, which may or may not even be standing anymore, was such a big deal to these folks. And to know that I was reading a column by Thomas Friedman in the New York Times the other day, and he was quoting a Russian turn of phrase that says this. It's a little morbid, but he says it's easier to turn an aquarium into fish soup than turn fish soup into an aquarium. Syria, largely because of Assad and other forces, was an aquarium that was turned into fish soup. Now the real work begins of going, how do we, not we as in America, but how can Syria become a country again?
Become
a country with a government that provides basic services to its people. Can it become a government that is not led by Islamic militants, but rather is a little bit more democratic with free and fair elections? These are all things that remain to be seen.
You know, every time something like this happens, it is a reminder of, one, how fragile these things we call governments really are,
yeah.
right? That there's this, especially I think for Americans, a bit of taking it for granted that we do. And just the normalcy. And just when I think about the number of countries that I've been to and how so many of them have governments that are in situations that are chaotic like this, right? And it just is also, I think, a reminder that, like, this is why we got to participate here,
yeah.
right? Because, like, we look at something, a place like Syria and their circumstance and say, it could never be us,
yeah.
when 1,000% tomorrow it could be us, right? and we see ourselves as a country inching toward it, right? When we think about some of the ways that we have responded when we don't like a political outcome and how those times have escalated. Yeah. to violence
yeah.
Several times. And so we, I think, need to be praying about Syria, but I think that there's something also about praying for ourselves and participating in ourselves and just choosing as a community, just having, if we can't agree on nothing else, to agree what we're not going to do is violence.
Yeah.
What we're not going to do is this type of corruption, and that we are going to, at all cost, maintain our free and fair elections. We're going to yeah. make sure that every 4 years we have an election, and whatever the will of the people is, that's who's in power.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's absolutely right. And I think the flip side of that is to appreciate what we have in America.
Yeah, gratitude.
That, gosh, I find myself in conversation with my kids all the time, like, you know, trying not to be too annoying about this, but just kind of pointing out, like, little elements of our lives that are not normal. You know, we talked about, it's a little weird, we talked about Assad at the dinner table last night and the idea of, like, what happened in Syria. And, you know, it's age appropriate, of course, but to go, you know, that, and even as I was describing Assad, one of my sons was kind of comparing him to other political figures. And it was just kind of
the fact that he knows about other political figures.
No, this is, Assad's on a pretty different level than
okay.
some of the ones that maybe they would know, because they're, you know, we're talking about not international here. To go, this is a little bit of a different deal. And to be able to go,
your son was naming, like, our politicians?
Yeah. And I'm like, no. That's
off air, I'm gonna ask you who he named.
Like, no, that's not
who
how
are we
it
comparing
goes.
To
that's,
Assad.
That's not how it goes. That's not how it goes.
Yeah.
But to be able to recognize that in America, we enjoy a level of freedom and also yeah. a level of, like, we complain about our government all the time,
stability.
And that's fine. But there is a level of stability here
yeah.
that is certainly unique in world history.
Yeah.
And I would argue is not unique in that it's the only one, but is certainly somewhat unique
no,
in the world, and that's something to be grateful for.
No, 100%. I, you know, when you talk about how you're raising your sons, it just gives me so much hope. I'm like, we're going to be okay. There are, because how old are your
so.
Kids?
I share the highlights. 13 and 11.
The fact that you and your 13-year-old were talking about global politics and that he was able to draw analogies or make comparisons or ask questions is a huge deal. And I think I just want to just add, and then I'll let it go. That there is something, I see this happen a lot with Christians, where we are so anxious to protect our kids that we don't inform them. And we let them go out into the world without information and without reasoning skills.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the fact that your boys are going to be able, wherever they land, whatever they believe, are going to be able to go out into the world and have meaningful conversations, one, because they are informed and becoming more informed, but also they're going to be able to reason.
Well, that's the hope, right?
Yeah.
That's the hope, is that we're able to be thoughtful citizens in the world. And that's another conversation
Love
for another
it.
Day, but yeah. And like I said, before we go pumping up my parenting too much, I'm sharing the highlights. We'll be right back. To quote the old Monty Python comedy sketches, and now for something completely different. On Sunday, December 6th, the one and only Taylor Swift performed in Vancouver, British Columbia, Pastor Judah, ending the Eras Tour, a tour that grossed billions of dollars, that was a global phenomenon in every possible way. We overuse the term unprecedented, but I think you could argue that this was an unprecedented tour in many regards. It started in March of 2023. By December, it had earned over $1 billion in revenue. They made a quote-unquote movie out of it. Like, you could watch it on Disney Plus. And obviously, you don't have to be a pop music person to understand Taylor Swift is a really big deal.
100%.
And I think you and I are of like mind about Taylor Swift, where we are like, she's great. We're not big fans.
Sure.
Not like anti.
That's right.
Like,
I probably couldn't list more than, you know, like five songs.
Do I have one Taylor Swift song on my workout playlist? I sure do. But we don't need to talk about that.
I'm not sure if I do. What's the song?
It's not even like a pump up song. Welcome to New York. I like the beat of it. It's fun. So anyway, we're not like, definitely not anti, not Swifties by any regard, but Pastor Judah, the tour is a big deal. And what do we have to learn from it? Or why was it a big deal?
I mean, one, it just speaks to like influence, right? Like that lady is so influential. Think about this. Yeah. This year, her name was a big name being brought up around the Super Bowl.
Yep.
Does Taylor Swift play football?
Nope.
No. Her name was big around the election. Taylor Swift a political in political office?
Nope.
Nope. But her influence, her is so big that now she is bleeding into other spheres that she has nothing to do with, which is I'm really curious like how that makes her feel. And I think, you know, I'm somebody who I don't have to love what you do to respect the craft, right?
Totally.
And I am not a huge fan of her music. I could not even tell you a whole lot about like her as an individual, but I have to respect how you can build yourself into such a global brand that like presidents are vying for you just to post on Instagram and say, hey, I like this candidate or I like that candidate.
Yeah.
That's a big deal. And I really respect her as a businesswoman. Mm-hmm. I was telling you earlier that like I actually had to like call myself out, and I want to be transparent about this just because I teach this a lot, and I want to talk about how I practice it, where I was like thinking about her and kind of being impressed by her business acumen. And then I realized that a part of the reason I was impressed is because there was some part of me that looked at kind of this girl next door, very pretty and very young, and did not assume that she could be a phenomenal businesswoman, right? Yeah. And so seeing her, I was a little bit surprised, and I held myself accountable because I said, well, Judah, if she was a boy, you wouldn't be as impressed. You say, yeah, he's a good business guy, right? And so I am impressed with her. I can imagine that there are probably a ton of barriers because of those things, because she is young, because she is very pretty, because she is a woman, because she does have that girl next door vibe. Mm-hmm. Probably a lot of work to get to a point where she is respected enough in her industry, not by us, you know, Joe Public, but by executives, by CEOs, by those folks to have built this incredible career. And I will tell you this, the people loved the Eras Tour.
Oh, yeah.
The people, and so I'm just like, shout out to our hyper-capitalist queen, Taylor Swift.
Take a guess. How much money, estimated, did her last weekend's show on Sunday night in Vancouver, how much money did that pour into the local economy in terms of tourism, spending, everything else?
Pour into the economy?
Yeah. It estimated concert series, actually poured is the word they use. Destination Vancouver Tourism Agency estimated the concert series poured blank into the local economy.
Let's see. When we're thinking about hotels, we're thinking about food, we're thinking about transpo. $1 million.
Take that.
Oh, gosh.
Multiply it by 157.
$157
million.
Now, I want to be clear. You're not asking how much money the concert brought in to her.
Correct.
But you're saying how much, because people came to see her concert, did it impact the city?
Yep.
$157 million.
Business school professor
million?
At the University of British Columbia, Jarrett Vaughn, turned the city upside down. He said, for one person to have such a big impact is really unprecedented. And now, if you want the Eras Tour to go on forever, there's a book. $39.99, and it's already sold.
Taylor, you better make your money. Sis said, I'm going to put on a concert.
Copies in
I'm
its first week.
Let's walk through this just for a second. Sis said, I'm going to put on a concert singing the songs that I already gave you on the album that you already paid for. Then I'm going to take the concert that you already paid for with music that you already paid for, and I'm going to put it into a movie that you're then going to come to the theater and pay for again. And then after you've done that, you can get the book about the concert yeah. that you watched in theaters, that you watched live for the album that you already bought. Y'all better put money in this lady's pocket.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not mad at it.
My last thing I'll say about her, and then we'll move on, is I have a high level of respect for those who can be intensely in the public eye and remain relatively free yeah. from scandal.
Yeah.
Say what you want about Rick Warren. And that guy certainly has a lot of detractors. Try to live a week with the level of scrutiny he has and maintain the heart and the character and the above reproachness in a lot of ways that he has. You look in the sports world, LeBron James, don't love the fact that on the Netflix show Starting Five, I don't think he knows any adjectives other than the F word. But apart from that, intense scrutiny, intense spotlight. Relatively free from scandal,
yeah, that's
right. Seemingly stable family. Taylor Swift, I would not want to live 20 minutes in Taylor Swift's shoes. She can't do anything. She is completely just trapped by her own celebrity.
That's right.
And yet has remained relatively free from scandal with that level of scrutiny.
And she
that.
Seems to have like this little element of joy.
I
like she doesn't
that.
Seem miserable. Yeah. I have one more thing to say about this, and then we'll move on. This is very important. Swifties, come to the front of the congregation. Want to talk to you about something little. It has come to my attention that some of you are comparing our good hyper-capitalist queen, Taylor Swift, to the legendary Beyoncé Giselle Knowles. And while
how do we feel about that?
While I respect Taylor Swift, from a talent perspective, it is not comparable, and I'll die on this hill. So you guys have got to stop going out into the world being dishonest. We can celebrate Taylor, but Taylor and Beyonce, they are comparable in terms of money that they bring into their concerts and influence, but in terms of talent, it's not even close. I said what I said. Don't email me.
Send him an email. Accost him in the lobby. I'm not here to defend
we
him.
We will debate.
There you go. We'll be right back. We are wrapping up here, and we are almost out of time, so we're going to do Blessed or Stressed, but today, Pastor Judah, I'm just going to present mine.
Uh-oh.
And you can tell me if you're blessed or stressed.
Uh-oh.
And then we're going to get on with our day.
Uh-oh.
So, headline in the Wall Street Journal, November 20th, 2024, sorry, kale, beans are the new nutrition obsession. Why everyone is excited about beans.
Who is everyone?
Article says, the humble bean, long a culinary bit player, has become the darling of nutritionists, high in protein and fiber and low in fat. Beans help lower blood pressure and cholesterol. Recent research suggests that eating beans frequently can improve gut health and might lower our risk of cardiovascular disease, obesity, and cancer. There are subscription services where people can get different sort of beans sent to them. And a lot of the enthusiasm comes from research showing that beans can help balance the gut microbiome, which reduces inflammation in the body and potentially cancer risk, as mentioned earlier. The article goes on to cite different studies that show all sorts of health benefits that folks experienced when they were on their nice high-fiber bean diets. And then it goes on. We will link to this in the show notes, though I think you need an Apple News subscription to see it. It has pictures of all these different kinds of beans, navy beans, black beans, chickpeas, kidney beans, Kalanelli beans, pinto beans, and all of their nutrient-dense goodness, and proceeds to offer advice for how to eat more beans. So my question for you, Pastor Judah, are you blessed or stressed by the fact that it appears that beans are having a moment as a nutritional powerhouse?
First of all, my favorite type of bean is vanilla bean in a frappuccino. That's neither here nor there. I am stressed, and here is why. I am stressed for your marriages, because y'all going to fool around and read this article and go home and eat all the kidney beans and lima beans and navy beans and blue beans, black beans, orange beans, jack and the beans, all the stuff. and you're going to fool around and dishonor your partner in the bed with all that flatulence. I am stressed. Don't listen. Go home, have a little bit of beans, but keep eating that kale because your spouse did not sign up to smell the impact of this article in your life. I'm trying to help you now.
Article says there is, of course, a reason that beans are dubbed the musical fruit. As the song goes, they can cause gas and bloating, especially if you're not used to eating them. And because of that, Pastor Judah, dietitians advise people who want to add beans to their diet to start slowly. Begin with a quarter cup, drink plenty of water that can avoid fiber-related issues, and more if you feel bloated, gassy,
you know, this is what happens when people don't read their Bibles, because y'all are sitting here trying to eat all this healthy stuff and kale and beans and all this stuff. But if you open your Bibles, Jesus, it says, took bread, carbs. And he said, I didn't say it. I didn't write it. He said, eat this in remembrance of me. There was not a bean on that Lord's Supper. And so I am stressed about this. I think that y'all going to be walking around. We're going to be smelling bad. Winter is coming. We're going to be in the house a lot. You're not going to be outside as much where you can get away with feeling a little gassy. Don't do this to your spouse. Listen, this is not God's dream for your marriage. And so I'm trying to be helpful. Pastor Brian, are you well, I feel like
Come
I know
on.
The answer.
Do you even have to ask?
Let me ask Kristen. Let me text. Yeah. Let me text your wife.
Okay,
and just,
first of all.
I'm going to tell her I'm praying for her.
Number one, I am totally blessed by this.
I know that she suffers greatly.
No, we're going to go TMI here. My body can metabolize beans just fine. Thank you very much.
We'll see if
now,
your wife agrees.
Granted, have plenty of practice being a non-meat eater, but I am, to cite some little Taylor Swift lingo, that irritates my wife. This is what really irritates, not the flatulence, is when I say things like, I'm in my beans era. For lunch today, I have potatoes, I have a mix of beans, and I'll put a little salsa on top, and we're going to call
Ooh,
it good.
The pressure and in your gut. I'm worried.
My gut is loving it. So,
but
it
your
is
wife
so
may not
no,
be.
No, it's all good. I can metabolize beans
Church,
without too much.
Just let's pray for our sister this week. Just all across. Come on, just wherever you are, begin to stretch your hands toward Lincoln and pray for the woman of God, because not only is she trying to love her husband and raise her sons and build her career, but every evening this man of God gets in the bed beside her, and who knows what that experience is like.
And it's, it is not nearly as smelly as you might think. So eat your beans, people. They're good for you. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.